Welcome to Transforming Education, Leadership Lessons. This podcast is hosted by Northwestern College. We're bringing you thought leaders who are influencing education and the world around them. Each episode provides new leadership lessons, so you can learn how to embrace your own influence.
Leadership has nothing to do with title or position. That leadership has to do with impact. And the role of a leader isn't to create followers, it's to enable more leaders.
Take away leadership qualities that inspire.
I think good leaders really get people brought together around a cause and can inspire them to be better than they were yesterday or to do something great.
Care about others.
We need teachers out there that are caring and compassionate and are interested in the student beyond the discipline that they're teaching.
Show people they matter.
We don't have a bullying problem. We don't even have a gun problem. We have a mattering problem.
By knowing you matter.
You matter to yourself first before you can matter to someone else.
So further your impact.
When you just authentically love your students, I just don't think you can help but grow.
Understand your core values.
You can tell pretty quickly any core leader whether or not he or she is there for the mission at hand, for the people that they serve, or whether they're there for themselves.
And align your mission.
Everything we do on campus, whether it's someone in the maintenance department or someone teaching in the classroom or to coach, it should tie back to our mission of impacting students for the cause of Christ.
Discover how to use your influence to inspire others.
That is why the relationships is so critical in everything we do, because when people know you care about them, they know yet they have your best interest, and then it sinks in.
Let's welcome our host, Gary Richardson.
Thank you, Leslie, and I want to thank all of you for listening to Transforming Education Leadership Lessons, where we bring in thought partners to inspire and influence your leadership. In this episode, we will be discussing leadership lessons with Noreen Bush. Noreen is currently the superintendent of the Cedar Rapids Community School District, and Noreen is a former building administrator and English teacher. While recently being named the Iowa Superintendent of the Year for 21-22, and also received the 2021 American Association of School Administrators Women in School Leadership Superintendent Award. We're honored to have Noreen with us today and want to share with all of you that she will also be our keynote speaker on March 30th at our annual trauma-informed conference to be held on the campus of Northwestern College this spring. So welcome, Noreen.
Well, thank you so much. I'm honored to be here and look forward to the discussion.
Good. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself so that our audience can get to know you a little better?
You bet. I'm in my 29th year as a public education educator. Although I was born in Detroit, Michigan, I really consider Cedar Rapids my home. Mm-hmm. We moved here when I was a kid, and I graduated from Jefferson High School. So I didn't predict in high school that I would be the future superintendent of the very district from which I graduated. But I'm super, super proud to serve my hometown. I would say that anyone who knows me probably knows that I serve with a full heart first, and I'm really passionate about serving children. I was a high school English, speech, and theater teacher, and I would say my path pretty much navigated through relationships. And so kids taught me so much. I never thought that I'd go into administration, but it was kind of taps on the shoulder of how can I serve kids to a larger degree and a larger degree. And so now here I am in a superintendent seat, but I've been honored to be a principal at every single level of education, high school, middle school, and elementary. And then also I have a background in trauma-informed care practices and was a principal of a residential treatment center, Prairie Edge, Four Oaks, and Cedar Rapids, serves kids with significant behavioral challenges and mental health struggles. And so that's certainly a passion area for me as well.
Interesting. Now, how many students and staff are in the system that you oversee?
So we have 16,000 students.
Yikes.
And their families, and then about 3,500 staff members.
Wow.
So we're big.
So the beginning of the year talk is to a lot of people.
A lot of people. And our greater community. I mean, our footprint is all over Cedar Rapids. You know, we have 31 buildings plus, and so we're everywhere. So we are a neighborhood school district. Yeah. And we're everywhere all over Cedar Rapids, and so have really strong relationships with our community partners in our city.
Well, that's a big job, and we're glad that you're with us today. We're honored to have you with us today. And as I take off on this leadership podcast, I want to just start out right with, how do you define leadership?
Well, I would say that I didn't know exactly maybe how to put it into words when I was in my early years. I think I just followed my heart and very student-centered practices. I know now, after research and through, you know, my master's programs, that I would say I'm a servant leader. And to me, servant leadership is about knowing a clear vision of what you want to accomplish for the bigger picture of an organization and for in K-12 for kids. But then secondly, listening as a leader to multiple people within an organization. And then after listening, co-learning together, learn together. And then really comes the leadership part. So to me, that's what leadership is knowing a clear vision of where you want to head as an organization, but listening, learning, and then leading.
Yeah, so expound just a little bit, if you would, Noreen, on the learning piece. Is that a systemic approach or something that you just do as a group or small groups?
You know, I think what we've learned, so, you know, here I am, as I said, 29 years of public education. And when I started my career in the early 90s, certainly research-based practices were part of my upbringing.
Yeah.
But we still were pretty much an autonomous profession, especially in the secondary setting. Like, I could close my door and teach and definitely collaborate with my colleagues, but there wasn't what I would say that collective efficacy. And now I think what we know about learning together as an organization is when you listen, and you do also data analysis, which I also think is a form of listening to your what's going on in your systems, then finding how do you move forward together. And it's not a guessing game anymore. We actually have research-based solutions. And so then it's learning what are the best matches for those solutions together as an organization. And it can't be done in isolation. Mm-hmm. We're such interdependent systems as educators, bringing those think tanks of groups together and somehow reaching consensus of how you're moving forward.
Yeah, very good. So Noreen, do you have a leadership hack, meaning tips, techniques, strategies that have worked well for you over the years?
So maybe I've kind of given some of that away already.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, well, I talked about this a little bit in my bio with you, but I just dove in to the work always and just got after what was in front of me and what kids needed. I didn't know necessarily that I was leading from the seat that I was in. I was just serving students as a teacher, as a coach, as a theater director. And I would get these taps on the shoulder from, you know, a curriculum director or from my department chair or from my principal to say, hey, would you be on this committee? Or, hey, would you do this? And I was always yes, because I wanted to learn and grow. And then as I grew over time, the same thing happened. I didn't necessarily think about being an administrator, but it was a tap on the shoulder of a former superintendent of mine who said, hey, have you ever thought about? And I was like, no, I'm not a principal. I want to stay near the kids.
Yeah.
It's like, just think about it. Just think about it. And so I think for the leadership tip that I've learned as I reflect about the leaders that I've had in my life is really those taps on the shoulder mean something, and giving people those seeds and things to think about. Because to grow capacity within a system, you have to have leaders at every level, leaders in classrooms, leaders leading buildings, leaders at a district level, leaders in the community. And when you have those folks who are so positive and can really lift the spirit of what the common vision is, taps on the shoulder make a big difference. So that's one of the things I think I've gotten better at over time is recognizing folks, telling them I recognize them and say, have you ever thought about even leading from the seat that you're in? You don't have to leave the classroom to lead.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, and an interesting segue into my next question on some future leadership. But I'm going to set you up here with some information from a book that's called The Future Leader by Jacob Morgan. that I've been reading that was suggested to me by one of our adjunct professors, Dr. Wendy Kerr, who teaches teacher as leader for us and instructional leadership. But anyway, in this book, there's a Gallup study of over 7,000 Americans, and it said that that one in two people leave their job to get away from their managers. In the UK, research published by The Independent found that nearly half of British workers believe they could do a better job than their boss. Perhaps the most alarming finding was the 13% that said their bosses are dangerously incompetent to do their jobs. Follows up with Gallup, again, on a study of global engagement, which found that only 15% of employees around the world are engaged in their jobs. And employees, this is what caught me, Noreen, employees, especially the stars, and we all know who those are that we don't want to lose, join a company and then quit their manager. And then finally, the Center for Creative Leadership found that there were results from studies they did, and they called it the leadership gap. Leaders are not adequately prepared for the future. Today's leadership capacity is insufficient to meet future leadership requirements. And that's across countries, organizations, and all levels of organizations. So when you say that tap on the shoulder and building capacity, this also follows up by the very end is asking us the question of, despite all of what we think we know, virtually every human indicator is telling us that we have a problem, yet most organizations and current leaders are doing nothing to address it, and we have stayed the same. So that leads, long-winded, I apologize, into my question of, what trends do you feel will or could impact the future of leadership, and possibly what might be the biggest challenges?
So, and I'm going to focus on leadership within education, although I know this is a global situation, no matter what market we're talking about. But I would say that what we face, I think, as educators, especially right now, is there in our country, there is a political climate that impacts leadership a lot. So I always say, as a superintendent, my job is to connect the community and the outside of the organization to what we're doing within our school and vice versa. Mm-hmm. But it's also my job to protect our school district from what I call noise that can be really distracting, especially to leaders. In school leadership, in schools in general, the number one thing that impacts students the most is the person in front of them.
Yep.
So that's the teacher in the classroom, the coach on the field. Those are the people that impact kids the most. When those folks don't have someone they can count on in leadership, that's when the cookie can start to crumble. So for us, we know as an organization, when we have 80 certified administrators in our district, okay, mm-hmm. we have to support those roles with a lot of listening, a lot of support, a lot of professional development, but common language, common expectations, common accountability, and coaching, 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 coaching. Everybody deserves a coach. And I will analogize this. If you think about just sports and coaches, you would never ask a coach of a volleyball team to sit in an office while her team is practicing on the court. For me as a superintendent, I can't sit in the district office all day expecting the leaders in my organization to just go out and do. They deserve observation. They deserve feedback. They deserve reflection. They deserve, solving problems together. And it's not just me that supports that. We have to build that collective collaboration together. And honestly, how to be vulnerable with one another. We as a leadership team studied Brené Brown's work together. Mm-hmm. And that is how do you lead with vulnerability and build a courageous heart. And it's really hard to admit sometimes as a leader, like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not sure what to do. And we don't want people leading in isolation. And I think that's when people leave a manager in an organization, or they don't have a trusting relationship with their manager or their leader, I really feel that there's usually some sort of isolation happening with that manager.
Right.
I have a theory that I'll call it an arenaism, but I call it about it's the improving versus proving theory. And I've worked with people in my life, like prove how much they know, or prove that they can do the job on their own, or even young practitioners out of the gate just want to show everybody that they're competent and they can do it. When you're in the proving zone and trying to prove to everybody how much you know or how competent you are, you're never going to live in the improving zone. And when you live in the improving zone, that's about vulnerability and saying, you know what? We can get better at getting better. And I want to live in a community and in an environment with shared practice. So when a principal can say to their staff, listen, we got this problem we got to solve. I have some ideas, but I'm going to need your ideas and your thoughts too on how we solve this together. That's what builds that collective efficacy and builds the confidence from staff to the leader. So when I think about the future of leadership, it's no longer this, you know, I use an analogy and I'll show it to you, although I don't on a podcast, it's hard to see, but if you make a fist and you take your other hand and you kind of pound down like a hammer,
yep.
That's what like demanding leadership can feel like and not collaborative. We say, here's the department or the school or the leader, and we want to lift them up and support. And the way that you build that support is through collective collaborative conversations. Although I'm the superintendent, I know like the buck stops with me, I don't have all the answers and I have to have others providing input, even students providing input so that we can build that collaboration together. So leadership of the future is not leading in isolation. It's got to be collaborative.
Yeah, that's very good. Leslie's heard me say this a number of times as a leadership coach through School Administrators of Iowa and New York City Leadership Academy. I think that's a very good piece that we lack. And I understand why it was dropped. Funding always affects that legislatively. But the executive coaching piece for school administrators seems to be one area where it's just completely blank. And if you're not doing it or have the skills to do it, then they don't get it. And then that leads to what I just read and you talked about is that people leave because of the manager because they don't have the skills. And the people that are in the system think that they can do it better, right? And maybe they can. I bet most of us get into administration because we've seen things that weren't effective or detrimental to kids, opposed to going, I really want to be a principal, because who really wants to do that, right? But when you can be effective and have collaboration and have coaching, then you're able to avoid a lot of pitfalls and mines along the way. So anyway, thank you for your thoughts there. We are visiting with Noreen Bush in this episode of Transforming Education Leadership Lessons. So Noreen, I'm wondering what advice you would give to aspiring female leaders as they seek out leadership opportunities as you have. Do they have to wait for that tap on the shoulder?
No, lead from the seat that you're in. I said that earlier. It's really anything from organizing, you know, collaborative efforts as a team. It is being willing to make yourself vulnerable and say, hey, I'm not exactly sure about this practice. I see that you're doing that in your classroom. Can I come visit? Can we have a conversation? It's initiating ways to share those best practices, but then also being willing to put yourself out there just to question a system. I love it when I have a teacher email me or call me and say, hey, have you ever thought about, you know, this? And I'm wondering if we could. And I love when people don't just present problems, but they also present solutions. And they say, I'm wondering if we could do this. And they're willing to explore possibilities. To me, those are steps of leadership. And even the smallest thing that may not seem like leading if it's making a difference in kids' lives and staff lives and the community's lives, that's leading.
Yeah.
And so I would say lead from the seat that you're in. Leadership is about action. It is not about position. It's not about title. And when you lead from the seat that you're in, you will build capacity and you will a formal leadership position. It will happen.
Yeah. So we know you had mentioned it in the beginning about being a certified trauma-informed, I'm going to say trainer. I might have the words wrong there. And you have a passion for helping those students with trauma in their background. And this spring, you'll come out, fortunately for us, and talk about this mantra of a message of hope, or hope is a strategy, as we talked about the other day. But what can we expect to learn from this message, Noreen?
So I'll talk about hope a little bit here first, yep. And then how the trauma-informed care practices, you know, work within that. So, you know, many years ago, I heard the quote, hope is not a strategy.
Yep.
And I remember thinking about that and saying, huh, I wonder exactly what they mean by that. And I think that they were synonymizing the word hope with a wish. You know, so if you think about blowing out the candles on a birthday cake, it's like blowing the wish in the air and just wondering if it's going to happen. I feel as though, both from a professional journey and honestly from my own personal journey, that hope is actually a strategy, because I've seen kids and adults who have hope and what that does for them and propels them forward. And I've seen kids and I've seen adults who are hopeless, and nothing is more tragic or fills me with sorrow than seeing kids and adults who are hopeless.
Yeah.
So the question then is, then what builds hope? So it's kind of like what I said about servant leadership. When there's a clear vision of success, or what success could look like. So I'll just talk about a second grader who perhaps has struggled with phonemic awareness. And the goal is that we're improving their phonemic awareness. And if they're getting acute targeted instruction and keeping a data chart and can see every week their improvement, it propels them forward. And that visualization of improvement, they start to see, oh my gosh, I can do this. And that fills them with hope that they can actually accomplish the task.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say hope as a strategy starts with that vision first of what does success look like, but there has to be a strategy to support what that vision is. But when people get results, like when people are doing a weight loss program, okay, here's my goal. Now I'm gonna get after it.
Yep.
And then they start to see the results. Then they start being filled with hope. I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. But hope actually has to start internally first in a belief. I've actually dropped the term buy-in when people's like, I got to get system buy-in. I got to get people to buy into what I'm thinking. I don't want buy-in anymore. I want you to believe in what we're doing. And when people believe, that's where the hope starts. And then I call our district a hope spot. And if you've never heard of a hope spot, hope spots are these beautiful ecosystems in the ocean that, despite all the environmental distress, they flourish and they create these new, unbelievable living organisms beneath the ocean. So you can travel and you can see actually designated hope spots in the oceans. And it's really, really cool. But I thought it's exactly what we are as a public school system, right? Despite all the stress around us, politics, a judgment, lack of funding, we have to lean in and look towards our kids and build a system of hope for them, that no matter what, we're still gonna help them flourish, learn, and feel loved. Leading with love, and nothing replaces love and building those positive relationships. So when you think about trauma-informed care, it's very parallel in that you're not leading with judgment of what's wrong with this person. You're leading with asking a set of questions of what happened to this person? How can I help? How can I surround you with love and support and help you grow and build hope within yourself?
That's really good. I have my own thoughts on hope is a strategy. It's a hot button when I hear that hope is not a strategy, as I've observed my wife sit through 350 intravenous injections and 164 of those being chemotherapy. And the hope brings a spiritual peacefulness that without it, or knowing that there's a could be a positive result, the despair of hopelessness is just the worst. And so I know that hope is a the main ingredient for trauma and trauma-informed people.
Yeah.
And so that message of hope is it really resonates, and it will resonate well for us on March 30th. So,
well, and your wife's story is certainly, you know, fills my heart right now. I'm in 2.5 years now of my cancer journey. And I'll say this, what fills me with hope every day. I have not cried once about having cancer like that. Like, I just wanted to get after it. It's like, what's the next thing? What in like learning more about what I need to do. But the thing that gets me emotional, and I will get choked up right now just thinking about it, it's the amount of love and the hope that other people have for me from my community, from my district, from my family, from my friends. I am currently participating in a clinical trial in Pittsburgh, and I go back actually next week to get an assessment about how we're doing. But I will say this, you know, research and understanding and having encouragement, I went on the next step and said, wow, let's give this clinical trial an opportunity, and fills me with more hope, not for myself, but also for the community of cancer and how far the research has come. Because I'll tell you what, if medical practitioners didn't have hope, where right. would we be?
Right.
And so as educators, we have to have hope of changes in our systems and getting better. And our practice is getting better for kids. I'm so grateful as a patient that my doctors are full of hope of change and research and practices getting better. And it just inspires me as a leader to do the same for kids.
You bring up some interesting points there, and I so appreciate what you've been through and what you stand for. And my wife, Sue, really was someone that people looked up to for courage and dignity and grace in going through all that. And I always said that it was more like there's a fly that's around and she's swatting it than it ever bothered her. She didn't lose a fight. She won a fight, ultimately.
Yeah.
But the story is that the doctors gave hope and would say, you know, in a couple months, there's this trial and Herceptin is going to be put on the market. And lo and behold, she was positive for who HER2 knew was the gene and the receptor. And this came on the market, and she was the first one that was able to take it in Spencer, Iowa, in the state of Iowa, many years ago. But it also provided more time, about 6 more years, because things occurred and in a positive way. But without having the hope, I'm quite sure that a person could have checked out many years before. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's a mental model state.
You right? would understand
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very much so.
So, Noreen, what are you curious about right now in the world of education?
So, I would say some of it's curious because I have some concerns. Some of it is curious because I just can't wait for the next thing to happen, and I'm excited about the next steps. So some of the curiosities I have is about building up our profession, and that we have fewer folks selecting our profession, and, you know, staffing concerns across the nation, honestly. So my curiosities are from an economic development point of view, from a big picture point of view. I'm trying to build capacity within Cedar Rapids community with CEOs and with leaders in our town to understand that we are the economic development spinal cord of the community.
Yep.
I mean, we are the future of, you know, our community. And so therefore, what do they see as their roles in supporting our profession? And so it's challenging because we have folks choosing to leave education and go into other professions. The pandemic, of course, bruised everybody, I think, and folks maybe wanted more flexibility or different options. So I am curious about how we continue to build our profession up, but also what are some of those creative solutions that perhaps we haven't thought about? I think we've had barriers in our profession that we've created ourselves. Sometimes it's certifications, sometimes it's like professional practices, sometimes, and we need to think differently about some of the best teachers I've had in my life weren't even certified teachers. And so how do we help kind of build that capacity of understanding, teaching and learning and loving kids as a community? So that's one curiosity I have. And another one I have is this continued work around innovative practice in engaging kids. We have magnet schools in Cedar Rapids. We also have what's called the Iowa Big Program, project-based learning, community-based learning program. And I think we have been kind of trying to shake the waters a little bit that there's more than one pathway to learn. And when we think about post high school readiness, there's more than one pathway to success there. I love the and thought. So kids who are getting some dual credit in high school and maybe taking some AP and doing internships and trying to find that best pathway forward for them, instead of like these former narratives of this is the only way, I know, for you to be successful. So I'm excited about those future conversations. I love watching all of you in post-secondary and how you start shaking the trees and thinking differently about relationships with businesses and the working world. And we learn from you about, oh man, how can we partner with you to make things happen for kids? So I'm very excited about the future landscape of those innovative practices.
Yeah. And then finally, what are you reading right now that might be interesting to the people that will listen?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm a bit of a Michael Fullan addict.
There you go. Yeah.
And so I don't always resurrect old books, but I came back to Fullan's Moral Purpose, a chapter from Maximizing Leadership. Last week, it was just a good, and kids in K-12 is not just about helping them be successful to graduate from high school, but really it's about growing citizenship of a great, for that they serve the world, right? They serve their communities. And so I did come back to Uncle Mike a little bit recently. We are a high reliability school district, and that is Barb Marzano's a research team of a school improvement practice. And so I'm actually teaching a course right now at Drake. And so I've been reframing it's about leading leaders with the HRS framework. So using that text as well. And then honestly, I've been reading a lot about my clinical trial, a lot of health research right now too, about things that I'm expecting to experience with this clinical trial that I've been.
So
this is really cool, called a TILS therapy. And so with my dysfunction, I'm a cervical cancer patient. And when I was diagnosed, I was very advanced stage 4 cervical cancer, metastatic, had spread to lymph nodes, liver, everything. And I had no idea I had cancer. And so cancer sneaking in, it is so sneaky.
Yep.
So I was really blessed with great support and chemotherapy, radiation, that actually after about 20 weeks of that, cancer was dormant, but we knew it would return. And so finding the pathway of keeping it out of my system has been my 2-year journey. So done a lot of immunotherapies, and I'll just say that my dysfunction on my T cells is a protein called PD-L1. And if you've ever seen commercials for Keytruda, a lot of lung cancer patients use Keytruda. That's an immunotherapy that attacks PD-L1. And I always say it's the secret handshake. That PD-L1 found the secret handshake with cancer to say, hey, come on in, you can party in the T cell. So we're trying to find the way to close that secret handshake. Keytruda did some things for me, but it wasn't the success. I was the first Iowan to be on a specific drug called Tivdak for cervical cancer metastatic patients. Mm-hmm. That did some work for me for about 6 months, but reorganizing the T cells in the body is hard. This particular cellular therapy takes the cells out of the body, teaches them how to behave and do their job, grows them exponentially, and then blast them back in the body. So I had a tumor extracted in May from a lymph node. that was cancerous. They had reprogrammed it and very viable. My cells showed a lot of viability for the clinical trial, and I was able to participate in the trial. So in late June, I was admitted to the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and for about 3.5 weeks was hospitalized. So they depleted my immune system, kind of similar to a bone marrow transplant. Yep. So I got a cellular transplant. So with my own cells. So they grew my cells exponentially over a couple of months, up to 100 billion of my own cells were grown.
That's a big number.
That are now programmed. I broke the clinical trial record. Yeah. And so that they then went, so after a week of heavy chemo and depleting my immune system and bone marrow basically being depleted, then they blasted me with my 100 billion cells that have been reprogrammed. And these are my own cells, TIL cells. So it's basically an immune system transplant. So I now have new cells that are trying to reprogram my entire immune system. And so the cancer journey is a little longer. We'll see how it starts kicking cancer out of the body. The idea is that I'm getting a brand new immune system that will no longer have dysfunctional cells. So I go back next week to see how I'm doing, and we'll see how the cancer is doing. But the cancer journey will be a little longer.
Yep.
But the idea is that I've got a whole new immune system will start kicking cancer out.
Yeah.
Crazy, right? Science is amazing.
It's amazing. Well, God bless you for what you're going through, what you stand for, and for the hope.
For the hope. That's always about the hope, right? Yeah. I'll say this, probably similar to how you described your wife, and I already feel a little heart connection there. Living life with purpose, faith, hope, that's how I wake up every day. I don't wake up every day saying, oh man, I have cancer.
Yeah.
And so in having those relationships, I just live my life with purpose. And I've been able to work the entire time through treatment, and wouldn't have it any other way.
Well, thank you for being with us today. When we get all this done, I'll send you this recording, and then you'll send me your photo and your address, and we'll get all kinds of good stuff to you from Northwestern College.
So, Northwest.
All right.
I love it. I love it.
If you need anything, if we can do anything for you, let us know. And thanks for joining us today.
Gary, so privileged, and thanks for having me. Yeah. Just thanks a lot. Enjoy the conversation and enjoy the time with you. Looking forward to your relationship.
All right. Thanks, Noreen. Take care.
You too.
Bye. Bye. Thanks to Noreen Bush for giving of her time and sharing her wisdom as we reflect on leaders that inspire and influence education and our world. And Leslie, what did you pick as highlights, which there were way too many? What did you pick out there that really resonated with you from Noreen?
Too many. My pen could not keep up, yep. Right? You can just feel the passion for serving children, for serving her community, for the families. She truly serves with a full heart, and that is so evident. And the conversation was just rich with Noreenisms, as she likes to say, and we will call them that as well. But her first formula for leadership was vision setting, listening, learning, then leading, which really fit throughout the entire conversation of stepping into those leadership roles, maybe even if you're tapped on the shoulder and empowered to do that, and not working in isolation. So not living in the proving zone, but living in the improving zone, and working together as building that collective efficacy is so important. She said, not leading in isolation, but leading in collaboration.
Yeah, I picked up this phrase. So there's one thing I'm going to add to this, Leslie, but it is the proving zone versus the improving zone. And there's a big difference. If you're trying to prove yourself, it's probably counterproductive to moving ahead positively. But if you're in the improving zone, you're looking to improve yourself and others around you. And I thought that was really good.
Exactly. And she gave so much advice for aspiring leaders and current leaders to start by leading from the seat that you're in, right? We can take every opportunity to continue to grow and learn in each of those spaces that we're in, and step in to finding solutions for problems, or thinking deeply about how we can bring students in, how we can offer more hope, how we can serve the community and make those connections even stronger. She said the number one thing that impacts students is the person that's in front of them, and they can't be doing that all on their own. Whether they're coaching or teaching, they need that community around them, and they need someone to support and have that common language, the common vision and message going forward.
And she mentioned Michael Follin. That's a true educator right there.
Yes, yes. And the moral purpose that he's written about.
Yeah, very good. Thanks so much for all of you for listening to Transforming Education Leadership Lessons. You have many options, and we appreciate you spending time with us. As a leader in education, you matter, and how you lead matters to a whole bunch of people that you serve on a daily basis. You were created for significance. As always, a special thanks to Leslie for co-hosting this, and Jackson sitting in for Mike. We appreciate his technical help. So for Leslie and Jackson, this is Gary. Until next time, inspire and influence.